Explaining Explainability. In this podcast, we bring together the different disciplines of the Collaborative Research Center Constructing Explainability. Two researchers discuss a concept around explainability from their point of view, moderated by Professor Britta Wrede.
Welcome to this episode of our podcast. So we have talked about many important concepts that are relevant for our research on constructing explainability, but one that seems to be actually the most difficult for AI systems is monitoring. So in a recent meta study, it was revealed that only 1% of XAI papers, that is research on the explanations of artificial intelligence, do user studies. So they do explanations without looking at the users. So this leads, of course, to explanations that seem either much too complicated or maybe simply boring or trivial. And so one reason why this is so, of course, apart from user studies being highly difficult also for computer scientists to carry out, is that monitoring is quite difficult. And so today we will explore this topic of monitoring with two experts from different disciplines, Hanna Drimala from computer science and psychology and Friederike Kern from linguistics.
Friederike Kern is professor for German linguistics and didactics at the Bielefeld University. Her research deals with learning interactions in everyday life and at school on the basis of videographic studies. A particular focus is on multimodal resources and their significance for interaction and linguistic learning.
Hi, Friederike. Good to have you here.
Hi, hello. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Hanna Drimala is a professor of human-centered artificial intelligence at Bielefeld University. In the Collaborative Research Center, she heads Project A06, co-constructing social science of understanding to adapt monitoring to diversity.
Yeah, hello Hanna, good to have you here.
Hi, what a nice to be here.
Thanks. Yeah, so again, welcome, thanks for coming. I'm actually very happy to have you both here because in a way you do very complementary things, I would say. So while Friederike is looking at how humans can or do monitor, or maybe do not monitor their partner during explanations, Hanna is developing methods for AI systems to do so. So maybe we can talk first about what monitoring actually is and what it is good for in an explanation, why we need that. So yeah, maybe this is actually at both for you. So why is monitoring important during an explanation? I mean, couldn't they just say when they didn't understand something or so? So why is monitoring really so important? Can't you do just speech recognition?
So I think that monitoring is super important to have smooth conversations. So like right now, you are giving me a little that you understand what I'm saying. And if you would interrupt me and just telling me, I have understood your first sentence, then this wouldn't sound very smooth. Okay. So we are all the time sending subtle nonverbal signals to indicate our understanding.
Okay, I see. And so are we humans really good at that, or are some better or not?
Well, I would actually add another thing to what Hanna just said. It's not only that it's important, it's basically what people do all the time. Monitoring is something that is really fundamental to human interaction. And we do it all the time. And the only way we start interaction or social interaction or social situation of any kind is by acknowledging each other's presence in a way that is that makes it possible to enter an interaction. So this is, I think, why it is very important to look at monitoring and how it is actually done by humans in social interactions in order to be able then to apply it to specific situations and also to human-machine interaction.
I see.
Just to follow on that, so we realize how much we do this all the time when suddenly someone is not sending us signals that we can monitor. So in psychology, there is a stress test where people are put under stress by not getting these signals. So
oh,
when
really?
People, so it's called the Trier social stress test, And there you are sitting in front of two other people, and they are not reacting to what you say. So they are not sending the subtle mm-hmm and nodding and smiling. And this really puts people under stress.
Oh, I see. Okay, because when you started saying that, I thought it was about politeness. But so this seems to be really, really important to just do
it's,
that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like sociological theories would say it's really fundamental to human interaction. And if you take it away from it, it's another stress test, which I find kind of, I mean, it's a stress test, but it's really funny. It's like when you're on a telephone and you kind of withdraw from giving verbal feedback by doing similar same thing. I always tell my students in the introductory lectures, if you have someone you want to, you're on the telephone and just try to withhold your feedback, signaling that you are not actually with them anymore, that you're not monitoring what they are saying, and they will get really annoyed and they will go, what's going on with you? Why aren't you saying anything? So, and this is another thing that if you actually withhold this kind of feedback, people react to this and people will say something about it. And this is an evidence that shows that it's really important and fundamental to interaction.
Oh, that's interesting. And would we, so I've understood now, if I don't give signals, that's not supposed to happen. What about negative feedback? Because negative feedback sort of, I don't know, you don't give that so directly. Is that also a good way to give it in this way, the negative feedback? So I haven't understood you or something like that? Or what?
I wouldn't consider the signal, I haven't understood you, as a negative signal. It's more a signal that guides the behavior of the other person. So if you frown, for example, I just know I have to explain in more detail or in another way. So it's not directly a negative signal, it's just a informing signal that informs me what I have to do next, explain better.
Okay, but that's only, and we are academics, right? So academics never acknowledge that they haven't understood something. So, I mean, right? So often you try to hide that you haven't understood something. Are we good at that? Can we do that? Or are we subtle observers and realize, yeah, he doesn't want to show, or she doesn't want to show, she hasn't understood, but I see she didn't. How good are we at? Is that an issue at all? So in your research, or does it not happen that people want to hide that they didn't understand something?
Well, not in this way. I mean, research, part of my research would try to find out how people actually signal understanding rather than non-understanding, but of course this can go hand in hand. Even through body posture and the way we move in certain situations, so when we are listening, might signal understanding or non-understanding. I'm not sure if people can actually hide it, because many things we do with the body, we don't really have a conscious way of of monitoring it. So I guess you can learn to kind of see the signals if mm-hmm. someone doesn't understand, but it's probably hard work.
I see.
I think hiding might be the smaller issue, actually, than influences that are not so voluntarily. So, for example, we look a lot at how, for example, stress or also hierarchy influences how open you show your understanding. And this might not even be a voluntary hiding of your signals. So, but it still makes the explanation process much harder.
I see. Yeah, okay.
It's probably also like situations we know from being in a seminar with students, and you explain something and then you have these like blank faces. And you go like, okay, so was it too hard? Was it too easy? Give me some feedback. And then they will look at you and go like, yeah, that was all right. Or they say, no, well, please do it again or explain again. But you sometimes they are, my feeling is that they're not even aware of not sending any feedback, because they think it's written in their faces, okay. But it's not. So you have to ask, and you have to follow up and say, you have to tell me whether I need to explain more or not.
Okay, yeah. But you also think that they are always aware or not, if they have understood something? I realized that, for example, when I take oral exams, sometimes I have students who didn't learn because they said, well, I did understand everything in the lecture. Well, I'm happy to hear that, but then they cannot explain it. So I have often the impression, I don't know, that it's not very easy for ourselves to realize if we have understood something.
Yeah.
You're both nodding. So we are doing a lot of non-verbal signals here.
I think this is a super crucial point for also developing machines that detect these signals, because we often asked, do you want to detect understanding, or do you want to detect whether someone thinks she or he has understood something? And what you described is whether someone thinks she or he has understood something. So whether I feel, okay, I got it, even if I haven't gotten it. And I think that it's actually also from an ethical perspective, the thing that machines could detect or should detect. The kind of real understanding, so whether someone really got something, even if he or she is not aware of it, is much harder to detect. And also, I think, much more problematic from an ethic perspective.
But don't we do it as humans? At least we try to do it. Like you said, at least in your lectures, you try to ask your students to give you feedback. But I mean, it's important that you understand if they did understand or not, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So there are certain situations where I think it would be good that you as a teacher have this ability to see, yeah, now they have understood, or I don't think they have understood. So where, I think, where is the ethical issue here? I see that there might be some, but just because it's a machine, or is it too intrusive?
I find it quite intrusive. So I think if all these signals, this nodding, the frowning, the smiling, when I have understood something or not understood something, are signals that I want to send, and I see a lot of value that machines pick that up. I'm very skeptical about machines kind of reading your brain and or reading your mind and getting an idea whether you really understood something, even if you haven't understood that you understood it.
Okay, so you would say that having actually an interaction with a machine is different than having an interaction with a human, because then I should be in control of what the machine is sort of explaining me?
No.
I see already, so no.
No, I also would find it intrusive if I'm not, and you say, no, you may think you have understood it, but you haven't. I can see this.
Okay.
I also find this an awkward human-human interaction, and the same for human-machine.
Okay, yeah, because we are colleagues, that would be very intrusive. But if we were at school, I mean, or if I say that to my child, I would think, that could be okay, because I'm really trying to help her or him. You wouldn't.
Depends on what you base your judgment or your assumption.
Experience? yeah, you nod.
Yeah. Maybe, I mean, you are mentioning a child. I think I find it also belittling. So I can see it towards a child. I find it even more problematic on the same balance.
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe just to add on this, I think we have more subtle ways of kind of testing whether understanding has actually taken place or not. So like even in a situation like you mentioned with a child, you wouldn't probably say like, well, you might have thought you understood, but you haven't really. You probably say, are you sure? Shall we try together? Things like this. So we have ways of testing this in kind of more polite and more subtle ways if we have some kind of doubt whether actual understanding has been achieved.
So. Yeah, that's interesting. So that's sort of the scaffolding part. So I see. So thanks very much. That was already the first part. And we will get actually to some more of the issues we have already touched here in the next part. So Friederike, in your project, that is A4, you have recorded how a person explains the game Quarto to another person. And so, yeah, what was your experience? How good were those participants to recognize the partner? I don't even know if they, did they know their partners or were they friends?
They didn't, no.
They didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does that play a role if you have, if understand, know somebody? Or, and what was your impression in these interactions?
Yeah. I mean, it might play a role. If you know someone well, you might be better at reading certain signs, but then again, I mean, even if he, this would be like kind of my approach to it, even if we talk to people we don't know, we always have like practices we use to like solve certain unproblematic problems, as like a sociologist would say, or sociologist. And so we always fall back onto practices, social practices we know from dealing with all kinds of people. And so what we would see then in such an interaction would be the use of practices, for instance, of monitoring or of interpreting signs from the others on the basis of our social knowledge about how the social order and the social world functions and works. And so coming back to our project, well, I mean, we had kind of two ways of looking at monitoring, and one was a kind of explicit way, because the people, the explainers were asked after the explanation, after the entire process, they were played video, parts of the video recorded explanations, and they were asked then, so why did you, for instance, switch from explaining this part or this aspect of the explanandum to a different aspect of the explanandum? And then the answers of the explainers would sometimes hint at the way they were, or that they were actually monitoring the explainees. So some of them would, for instance, say, I had the feeling they didn't understand, or I had the feeling that they were more interested in this, or the explainee, they would even say, the explainee, the other, they had brought up this aspect, so I thought I would follow them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a very explicit way of monitoring and also studying monitoring.
Yes,
they're both really, because I mean, this is actually another question maybe that's really difficult to answer, is how do we actually study then monitoring? But this is also like monitoring verbal, only the verbal part of what's being, what's actually, what the resources in the interaction verb is. So in the other part of the project, we looked at more multimodal resources, like, for instance, gestures used. And we could see, for instance, the explainer uses a certain gesture to illustrate something, part of an explanandum, and then the explainee would reuse this gesture in a slightly modified way. And this, of course, shows monitoring also from the side of the explainees. So they take over certain multimodal aspects, reuse them, and then they might even be reused by the explainer. And like this way of kind of reusing and acting upon resources used by your co-participants also shows like very subtle monitoring of what they're actually doing besides what they are saying.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I already get a feeling of how you're working, because my first question was, how do you get a ground truth? But I'm not sure if that's really interesting for you. Are you interested in whether or not they are doing it correctly? So you asked the explainers, right? Why did you switch? And they said, well, I had the impression they didn't understand. But did you try to verify if the explainee had really not understood?
Well, we didn't. In this part of the project, we will try to do to pay more attention to this in the next part. It's actually something that's really difficult to to get access to. So we had a questionnaire that asked for like subjective understanding, but that of course doesn't mean that they have really understood. But at this time, or in this part of the project, we weren't so interested actually in this question, whether it was true or not, because we're more interested in how the interaction actually works, despite, you know, ignoring first what the outcome with respect to understanding would be.
But I, because I was wondering, maybe it is also just also already helpful if I, as an explainee, see there is an explainer who tries to make things understandable to me, and maybe it makes it easier for me to understand if I see you repeat things, even if I have already understood you, you repeat it again. That might make it easier for me. Maybe to also, I don't know, well, that gives me time also, and so on. So maybe this is a whole situation sort of helps me to better understand. We have seen this in different, we have seen this in different, or we have the hypothesis that this might happen in other situations.
Right.
So,
Which
is very confusing for a computer scientist, because I think if there is a sign of non-understanding, then I explain, and if not, then I don't. Mm. But it seems to be more complicated. Yeah. Yeah, maybe, Hannah, what do you, or how, well, how, what is the question actually in your project? So in A6, stress comes sort of into play. So how do you go about that? And what is your research question behind that?
So in A6, we focus on problems. So when the monitoring actually doesn't work well, so when due to either stress or due to mental health disorders, so psychological diseases like autism or social anxiety, the nonverbal signals may be different than kind of normally. So we also focus on explanations, like all other projects, but most of the other projects focus on kind of normal, with shadow quotes, people in relaxed or normal situations. And we thought that it's great if machines work for monitoring signals in normal people in normal conditions, but we think very often people are not in a relaxed state, and very often people have some issues. So every third person has some mental health condition during their lifetime. So it makes a lot of sense to make these machines that monitor signals of understanding inclusive. And that's our main aim in A6.
Can you already say something how the signs change? So do the signs of non-understanding change, or maybe do the, well, sort of the background signs change? Because I am stressed, I always might have signs of non-understanding that would normally count as non-understanding. Can you say something about that?
Sure. So we investigated the non-verbal signals in a game with and without stress, and compared these two conditions. And in general, we focus for now on the facial expressions, and in general, people show reduced facial expressions. So they signal their understanding, but also their confusion less. So that's our first finding.
In a stressed situation?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And that's kind of matching also other research about how people react when there is a person of higher hierarchy in the room. So, for example, if you are there with your boss, you also normally reduce your signals. And that's also what we find. And we are now looking how to make machines adaptable for those influences.
Do you reduce only the signs of non-understanding? So we have talked about that, right? So I don't want to show my boss that I didn't understand. Or do I reduce all kinds of signals like, oh, this interests me and so on, because I don't, for whatever reason?
So right now I would say it's still preliminary, so I wouldn't make too big claims here, but for now we found it in both conditions, so in both cases, so for understanding or for kind of smiling or for raising your eyebrows that you understood it, like you do right now. And also for kind of negative aspects like confusion, where you're more frozen, for example, and booze is reduced.
That's interesting. So I now look a little bit to Friederike, if you can confirm from your perspective, or is that news to you? Do you say, well, that's interesting, I didn't know that? Or would you say, yeah, well, from my perspective, I knew that already.
No, I actually didn't. So thanks for being able to learn. acquire new knowledge here. But it is absolutely, it makes absolute sense from my perspective that this is actually going on.
Why?
Well, good question. Because I think other things basically come into play and are more important than, or sometimes we just don't want other people to know what our actual state of understanding, also what our emotional states are. Mm-hmm. And so we try to hide it. I think it makes absolute sense that we don't always want others to know how we are or what our states are. And of course, the less kind of relations I have with the other person, or if the relation is kind of hierarchical, as you said, that makes it for us maybe all we want in this then want to hide ourselves more. May I pick up on one thing, because I have a project running on autism at the moment, on autistic children in school, and one of the things that's always been said, but that we can actually observe, is also in these very natural environments, is that certain signals of monitoring, like for instance gaze, which is really very important, but also things like posture, whom do I turn to when, at what stage in the conversation or in the interaction, is actually often not working so well with autistic children, which actually doesn't mean that it's always a problem. Sometimes very much depends on the interactants, on the co-participants. Sometimes for them it's absolutely no problem. Sometimes it's a problem and it's made a problem. But we have very different signals of monitoring and of disengagement or engagement in interactions from people with certain mental disorders or not neurotypical, neurodiverse people. And I think we have to learn a lot more about this in order to be able to deal with this in interactions. So
this is super interesting to hear, because that is exactly what we are focusing right now in the project A6. So right now we are collecting our data set together with the university ambulance, there we are doing the same paradigm, so the same game explanation, also with and without stress, but with many different mental health disorders, so patients with mental health disorders, to exactly investigate that, so to see how different are their signals. As we know from other research, in general, they do show different nonverbal social signals. So it makes a lot of sense that they also show different nonverbal monitor understanding signals and confusion signals in explanations. So, for example, gaze, that this indication of understanding via your gaze is different, or that the facial expressions we know are different. So probably also facial expressions of understanding are different for them.
So thanks. I think this is super interesting, and to see also how you actually address very similar phenomena from very different perspectives. Thanks for this. This was the second part, and we now switch to the third part. Yeah, so I found that super interesting to hear from your different perspectives. And actually, what occurred to me, actually, Friederike, I am really impressed by what you as a researcher can see in interactions. So when I see an interaction, people explaining things to another, I would just say, yeah, yeah, they explained something he understood, and I don't know, it went well. And then I listen to somebody like you, and you see a lot more in there. Yeah, so I don't know, can you say something about that? How, also, is it something that you learned spontaneously, or did that take long, or do you have theoretical background to that, of what you are looking at? And do you see that also in our everyday interactions? Like Hannah, if you see all the eyebrows raises that I do. Yeah, sorry. How do you get there, and what do you do to do that?
Mm-hmm. Maybe what's really important is that, of course, if you see a video of someone talking to each other, then this is, it's very kind of fluent, and it's a way. So we have this way of making this more accessible, a video. And so transcriptions are really important part of our process. So, and our transcriptions of what's being said and of certain social situations are really very, very elaborated. For instance, if you have 1 hour, 1 minute of talk, you might sit for 2 or 3 hours to transcribe this. And this just gives you an idea how much work this is and how important, but it's a very important step in our research, because by transcribing very carefully what's going on in the video, not only what's being said, but also all these kind of multimodal signals, embodied signals, and also how people turn to each other, what the gaze is doing, description of the gestures, and so on. It all goes into the transcript. And what I personally find really fascinating, this is why I ended up in this kind of research, is that then when you look at it and look at the transcriptions that are very rich, you often realize how extremely ordered behavior is. You look at, coming from linguistics, there's a tradition saying that, all talk is always really disorderly, and you can't use it as an object of research because it's so disorderly, it's unsystematic, and it's not worth looking at it. And of course, this has changed a lot ever since we were able to tape oral talk and then transcribe it and look at it and see like how ordered it is, and how every break we make, every little pause has a function and is reacted upon. But in very different ways, of course, but also in very ordered ways. I find it extremely fascinating, and also this kind of how gestures are made and then used and reused and kind of, you know, and changed a little bit with which people signal that they're actually monitoring each other, that they using each other's, acting upon each other's actions. All these things become only accessible when you find a way of transforming them into other ways of, into a different kind of data. So transcription really, which I also found really challenging in this interdisciplinary TRR, is that for many of our colleagues, like in the project, transcription or transcribing was, please do your transcriptions really fast so that we can work mm-hmm. with them. And then we always like, oh, we can't, because it's like so important for us and it takes so much time. And this was one of the challenges of interdisciplinary research, acknowledging that other steps in research in other disciplines are very you have to acknowledge that it's actually a lot of work. I mean, it works with all disciplines, but it's something that we actually were confronted with a few times.
I can understand. I don't know, Hannah, if you want to comment on that.
On the point before. So I find it super interesting to hear in detail about the transcription, because probably, as you just pointed out, the misunderstanding how much time it takes, I also think had a well, probably still have, a superficial understanding how these transcription processes look like. Also because it's so different from what we do when we analyze the videos. So also from a computer science perspective, we are trying to make sense what is happening in the video, but it's like a completely different process. And it's so interesting to hear how it goes and what it all involves.
Is it really just a different process, or is it maybe also because you're asking different questions? I was just wondering, because I think you already have probably in mind the categories that you are looking for.
Those is probably right. So we do have a bit different questions, or not, we do have also different questions. So like you said in the very beginning, when you asked for the ground truth, so we care a lot about that. So we let people over the whole video indicate their subjective understanding, so that we have a ground truth for every kind of frame of the video. And that's because we have a different question. So we want to build machines that can detect these subjective understanding. Mm-hmm. But I see a strong similarity, especially when you just explained how you do the transcription process, in making sense of the video, transforming it into something that can be read without looking at the video. So the representation of the video, in your case, a transcription, in our case, the automatically extracted facial expressions, or the automatically extracted features of the voice, or the directions of the gaze. So we also kind of end up with a representation of the video, a description of the video and every moment of the video, but in a very different way. And I think there's a lot of value. And I'm actually wondering, I think it is happening in some of the TRR projects, but I'm not aware how the progress is currently going. The benefit of combining these two, because obviously there's a lot of benefit.
Yeah, I was also wondering, would you find value in also getting automated transcriptions of the interaction for you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's a bit of an empirical question, actually.
Yeah.
how much it kind of helps to answer, like, for instance, our research or my research questions. But it would be definitely worth trying, because, yeah, it's a different perspective. So the focus will be on different things. And of course, if we do our transcriptions, we always make decisions, because we can't transcribe, we can't put down in writing everything we see. It would just be too much. So we take all these kinds of decisions, which is exactly why it is so important for our research to do this step. But then you make other decisions, so it would be interesting to see what your understanding of what's been seen in the video is in comparison to ours, and then see if it actually helps to answer either of our research questions.
That's very interesting. And maybe we can, yeah, it would, to bring these two perspectives really together also for AI explaining systems. So how would you see your role in these kinds of systems, in developing these kinds of systems?
Mm-hmm. So our role currently is in first getting a databases that enables or allows to build inclusive algorithms for detecting monitoring. So our main aim of ASICS is still building machines that are able to detect whether someone understands something or is confused, to allow machines to adapt, to make the explanation more fitting to the understanding or non-understanding. And for actually making this inclusive, so working for stressed persons, working for persons with mental health disorders, we are currently collecting this large data sets of people under stress and people with mental health conditions, and training new models and refining models and seeing how you could also build models that adapt automatically, because I think it doesn't make sense to build a monitoring model for every condition, so that you have a monitoring of understanding model for people with autism conditions, or a model for people with social anxiety, and a model, it's just too many. So, and also, I don't know, for states, so for being stressed or being hungry or being tired. So there are many things or situations you could think of where it might be reasonable to adapt your model, but I don't think it makes sense to have a separate model for all of these different states.
Yeah, and you're not just talking about the monitoring, right? You're talking about the scaffolding. So have a scaffolding model that takes all these things somehow into account, right?
That's a kind of like last step.
Yeah.
So when you actually are able to accurately monitor the understanding and the confusion, then I think you could adapt the scaffolding.
Okay, yeah.
But I think we are not there yet.
Which is a pity, but I would like then go to Friederike again. Would you already have, well, yeah, I wanted to ask, could you give some advice with your background and your, well, you have, I think, probably the most experience of how interactions go, right? Explanations between humans, because you probably have looked at more explanations than we probably have. And do you think you could give advice how these AI systems should scaffold, for example, when a person is under stress and didn't understand and so on? You know what I mean? Could you derive something? Because what you're doing, right, is very qualitative in a sense. You really try to look at instances. But on the other hand, of course, you also have a big theory in mind behind that, right? And so I think are there frameworks that can generalize from these instances that you see?
Mm-hmm. Well, with regard to monitoring, but also with regard to very basic structuring explanatory interactions. So for instance, like in every explanation, you always have this phase at the beginning where people kind of try to come to an understanding, to mutual understanding about what the explanandum actually is. And then there is this mutual acknowledgement, okay, now we know this is, you want to know this, or this is the explanandum, and then the explanation proper kind of follows. And I think it would be good for AI systems to be able to recognize these phases, so that there is always at the beginning this, oh, what are we actually talking about? What's the question? What's the explanandum? And then be able to monitor and also to be part of the transgression from one phase to the other phase. Mm-hmm. So this would be, and this of course would entail to be able for the system to be able to recognize monitoring signals and also produce monitoring signals in certain ways.
This is interesting. I had to smile because I was thinking of our own system, and I realized, because we focus on very different parts of the explanation, that is a part we don't focus on at all. So what we do is the system will say, okay, now we explain this. I do realize, of course, how this is very different from how humans would do it. I think I got an impression of how you're doing it. But, and also, Hannah, in your project, how you really try to integrate all these different individuals, actually, how we can monitor. So thank you very much. The time is up. We could discuss a lot more time and longer. So thank you for being here. And thank you for tuning in on this episode, to all the listeners of Explaining Explainability podcast. And yeah, stay tuned.
Explaining Explainability. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you have any questions about this topic, feel free to ask them in the comments. We look forward to welcoming you to our next episode.